Welcome to Biz Rocket Radio with Stone Payton and John Baker. John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. And now, get ready for Biz Rocket Radio. Here's Stone Payton and John Baker.
Welcome to Biz Rocket Radio. This is John Baker, and we are here in our new facility over at Rome on the north side of Atlanta. And happy to have you all with us today. We've got three guests that are going to be going through some of their experiences, some of the challenges they've had in the past, and a lot of the successes that they've had. Hopefully, we'll gain some insight from talking to them. Biz Rocket Radio is an opportunity where we get a chance to chat with executives and business owners, and today we have three of those that they're going to share some of their backgrounds with us. So we're going to get right into it with Mike Esposito. Mike is with Home Depot, and he is a director of associate relations in the Northern Division. And Mike, I want to welcome you in on the show.
Delighted to be here, John.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background, and we'll kind of start from there.
Background, as you're aware, is quite varied, but I actually got my first real job in human resources for Exxon after graduating from Ohio State. I was at Exxon for a number of years in HR. While I was there, I ended up going to law school nights, earned my law degree, and then was a practicing attorney in labor and employee relations for over 7 years. After that, I joined ADT Security Services as their in-house labor and employment counsel. This was up in New Jersey. We moved our headquarters to South Florida in Boca Raton in 1996. Less than a year later, we were bought by Tyco International. Some people say Tyco stands for, at the time, take your company over, which is what we actually did, which is what they did with us. That turned out to be a blessing. I got promoted up eventually to head of HR, and over the next 4 years, we went from about 850,000 in sales to 4 billion. We acquired 220 alarm companies, became the largest electronic security provider in the world. So it was a great run.
Yeah. Yeah, so you started in HR, you kind of got your law degree while starting things off, and then kind of paired that back into the HR again, right?
Very much so. Yeah, and sometimes people ask, is being an attorney an asset or a liability? When it comes to the type of work that I do, and it could be both, and I've experienced both. The first one is as a liability. I would argue to you that it's attorneys are trained in risk avoidance, which they're terrific at. But if you weigh too heavily in that direction, it can hamper the growth of the business. In my case, that's exactly what I did. I was both labor counsel and head of HR. And I still acted like a lawyer when I'm supposed to be leading and energizing, 25,000 associates. So
seems like a fine line. How do you walk that line? It's like a lot of times we have attorneys, obviously in our business, as you could tell from the disclaimer in the beginning of the show, that we call, they're not business generators. They're business, wet paper towels. So how do you make that a good balance that fits?
That's a fair question. How do you make that a good fit? Well, one thing I was blessed with was a president named Mike Snyder, who was just a remarkable leader and visionary. And he saw something in me that he said, well, you're my head of HR, but you're still acting like a lawyer. So he sent me to a week at Stanford's business school. And I was with about 30 HR executives from around the world. And based on the fellowship I gained there, the insights I gained there, I came back, the scales fell from my eyes, and I realized you can't manage a business by focusing on the 5% who break the rules.
Yeah.
Mitigate your losses as best you can, but at the end of the day, worry about the 95% who are there to come to work and do a great job. But the flip side of, I think, being an attorney, particularly if you're in private practice where you eat what you kill, customer service.
Yeah.
Customer service. Yeah. It's about understanding how to ingratiate yourself with your customers. And when you're in a corporation and you're a support function, whether it's law, IT, one of those, oftentimes they don't know how to provide true outstanding customer service to their internal clients because they have a captive audience. The client has to go to that HR person, has to go to that IT group. So I think sometimes being an attorney who's been on the outside, who has to develop business, understands that it's all about the client. In our case, it's all about my internal customers.
And now you're with Home Depot and applying those skills to our local home building store here in the Atlanta area. Tell us a little bit more about your work with Home Depot.
Actually, what I do with Home Depot is probably the best of both worlds. It integrates my legal training and background with my human resources experience because I'm called a director of associate relations. And the primary mission I have is to help promote positive associate relations with our associates. How do you bring engagement into the workplace? And in the Northern Division, we're broken up into 8 different regions. I have a regional associate relations manager in each one. And they're tasked with a small part of their job is putting out the proverbial fires, addressing serious claims of sexual harassment, union organizing, workplace violence, things like that. But the lion's share of their job is really to promote associate engagement so that when you walk into a Home Depot store, you feel you're home, you're welcome, and they're there to provide you with outstanding customer service. That's a big part of our job today.
Well, it sounds like you've got another kind of alter life in terms of the whole speaking lecture world. You understand that you do a lot of speaking, and I don't know if it's motivational speaking or focused on network investing, I think you
right.
talk about.
What happened after I left ADT back in 2004, I was recruited away to be the head of HR at a Fortune 90 company. And so that was like the big deal.
Yeah.
You know, I went from $4 billion to $25 billion, top dog, 22nd, you know, overlooking the Atlantic Ocean from Fort Lauderdale. Life was wonderful,
yeah.
Except that it wasn't for real. Within 6 months, I was let go, part of a reorganization. And it was, I was unemployed with a wife and 2 kids in South Florida. Now what do I do?
Yeah.
And
there's a lot of people have been in that situation recently.
Exactly. And this was before the bottom fell out of the economy. And so I realized that most of my career had been self-serving, not helping others, focusing on my job, and never gave a second thought to possibly losing my job. And it took me 14 months to find this job with Home Depot, and it was a blessing in many respects. But along the way, the journey was I learned how to find a job. I learned that it was about paying it forward, building relationships, be selfless. And if you help people, what goes around comes around. And it sounds elementary, but many of us, including myself because I'm the poster child, just didn't do that. We got too caught up in too many other things. And so what happened, I got to Atlanta, continued paying it forward, got on the board of the American Red Cross here in town, and started coaching people. People would come in, they'd hear about me, they'd want to meet me for lunch, I'd talk, listen to their stories, and then they'd say, would you mind coming to speak at my organization? And I said, sure. So for the last 5+ years, I do a considerable amount of public speaking on my ministry of helping people who are in transition, and much of it is about building productive giving relationships with other people, because there's a lot of subject matter experts out there. There's a lot of people can do what you do. The question is, what is the relationship you have created so people will be open to helping you because they understand the real you? And you don't get that by just like a random drive-by shooting. You got to get out there, go shoulder to shoulder with people and help them, and it works.
I've seen a lot of people involved in networking groups here in the Atlanta area do that a lot myself as well. One of the things that I found that a lot of people have a problem with is once they land, you know, when you're in transition, your world is that transition. Your world is the networking and kind of making those contacts and paying it forward. And then once you land, they talk about keeping that up, you know, continuing to pay it forward, investing in your networking group, continuing with LinkedIn and being active with these groups. But it's so hard to do that. What advice do you have for people that are out there that are maybe landed, but know that position that they were in to keep feeding that pipeline and continue to being part of that networking group?
That's a great, that's a really great question, because that's what happens. I would say the majority of people, they land, and all the things that they did to help them secure that job go out the window because they're now 100% focused. And more often than not, I hear from those people say, Mike, I'm back in the market. And I think, well, I didn't even know you got off the market.
Right, you're out and in so fast.
Right, and so the short of it is, I think part of it has to be with find something you're passionate about so that it's not work. If you're passionate about supporting a nonprofit, if you're passionate about supporting your alma mater, I'm on the board of the Ohio State Business School as well. If you're passionate about these, then it's a matter of building those into your daily routine. And you get to know people, they get to know you, and your network will spread. And at the end of the day, successful networking, I like to consider it building productive relationships, John, takes work. It takes work. There are things I can't do and won't do because I'm out there networking with people, building relationships with them, seeing how I can help them. And it takes a lot of work. And some people just don't want to put the time in.
Yeah, it is definitely a sacrifice of time. It seems that when you move away from it, even for 3 months or 6 months, you start becoming kind of a past known and somebody else has filled into your shoes. Have you found that to be the case?
Yeah, you can become quickly irrelevant. People forget who you are, where you came from. And one of the questions people have is, well, how do I re-engage people? And part of it is, again, it takes time. It's pinging people sometimes with a timely text, timely email. And you affirmatively reaching out to people. And like, for example, everybody has to eat lunch, or everyone should eat lunch. How are you spending your lunchtime? And if you figure you've got 5 days a week, 2 or 3 days to connect with people, invite them in, buy them lunch, be a gracious host. But again, it takes work, it takes a plan, and it takes perseverance. And it takes a heart of giving. And you know, I got changed. I had my epiphany, and thank God I haven't went back to the old way, because that's just not productive. It's a much richer life when you're paying it forward and helping people, but it does take work.
And it does seem like there's a silver lining to going through transition, and that seems to a lot of times be the case, is people to get a chance to get outside of their normal, traditional habits and the things that they do on a daily basis and step back away and go, are those things that I'm doing really important to the overall scheme of what I'm all about?
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of like spending your life climbing the ladder only to get to the top and realizing I put the ladder against the wrong building. like, now what the hell do I do? And it's true. I mean, for me and for most people, although the journey is hard and it can be enervating, it can be depressing, it's all of those things. But it's what did you learn along the way? And you learn that what's really important to you. Who are the people who are going to support you? What can I do to make myself better at building relationships with people? And that's something that carries over after you land your job. But it is fraught with pain. The people I talk to, oftentimes, they'll either at their ministries, at their churches, their organizations, who will come to meet me. These people are not having a ball.
No.
But I try to reassure them that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. There's a way to get there, and take what you can, the gifts that the Lord has given you during your journey, and you'll reap a harvest of that at the end.
What suggestions or advice do you have for people that have been out for a while? You know, they're going on 6 to 12 months, maybe longer, that they've been out, and they either need to get re-energized or figure out a different process. What do you suggest?
That's a great point, because a lot of people, like I was one. This was in 04, 05. I was out for 14 months. People now are out 1, 2 years, even more. What do I do? What do I do differently? Am I doing the right things? And one of the things I would suggest is get professional help. A lot of people will invest money in, hopefully in your case, John, financial planning. But they'll get a personal trainer in the gym. They'll pay for that. They'll pay for yoga lessons. They'll pay for tennis lessons and the like. But they won't pay for someone to help them with perhaps the most single biggest item in their career is their career.
Right.
So if you get, because a lot of people will go person to person. Well, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? What do you think? Well, you look at my resume. Look at my resume. Look at my resume.
Yeah.
And what I would suggest is get somebody who you can trust, who is knowledgeable, and sit down with that person and build a relationship with that person. I wish I had done that, 30 years ago. Find a coach who I thought I could support me in my journey, and that's then a constant barometer to help make sure you're on the right path. So I think that's a very important thing that most people won't do, either because they say I can't afford it, or I don't need that kind of help. And Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult to stay on the right path.
A lot of people are obviously going through or have been through that transition. And coming out the other side, when they land, they do seem to be more developed and richer. What do you think that you've brought to Home Depot that you wouldn't have brought to them not going through this 14-month process?
I think there are a couple of things. One of them, every day I thank God for the gift of Home Depot. I don't take for granted what I have there. And so when something comes along and it might be an internal customer who I think is acting like a jerk or being too demanding, I think, thank God that I have that person who comes to me for some support or help for me or my team. So I think it's an element of gratitude that I think a lot of people sometimes take for granted where they are. And the other thing is the importance of building those relationships with people, because what I learned about doing on the outside, I try to do that on the inside as well, and I think that's made me a more effective contributor to the enterprise.
Is there any way for people who are going through transition, what's the best way for them to describe that advantage to maybe a possible employer who's looking at them going, Jesus, you've been out of work for 18 months, man.
Right.
You know, nobody wants you. You're kind of a mutt. I don't want you either.
Right.
How do they turn that into a positive?
One way you think you turn it, and you're very good at this, John. I think one of the things I explain to people is, and I referred to it earlier, is find something you're passionate about. And so what I suggest is, okay, generally I'll ask a couple of questions. What nonprofits are you associated with? Answer, my church. I said, other than that, because those people are all like you. They look like you. They sound like you. They talk like you. They sit in the same pews every Sunday. I said, what else are you involved in? And generally, most people aren't involved in anything. So then I tell them, I said, find a nonprofit that you and your family can be passionate about and embrace it. So we'll use the Red Cross as an example. And I'm not saying getting on a board. I'm just saying being a volunteer. I said, find that nonprofit, get on the board. Find that nonprofit, do something there, and then you can put that on your resume. For one thing, it looks good on your resume. But also what it does is it gets you out of the house. It makes you feel that you're contributing to people, because psychologically unemployment is a real downer. And then what happens is you meet people there, which can help towards building relationships and networking, but also you finally get an interview, and someone looks at your resume and they say, so what have you been doing while you've been unemployed? Well, typically I say, well, you should be looking for a job 35 plus hours a week. What are you doing the other 40 hours that you're awake, other than dropping the kids off at school and going to the gym and walking the dog?
Right.
And what you say then is, well, I actually do volunteer work for the Red Cross. Really? Oh, I see that on your resume. What do you do? Well, actually, I had to go to a two-week training program to get on the disaster action team. And I reserve two nights a week to go out responding to fires. No kidding. And in fact, if you don't mind, I'd like to give you an example of the last fire I went to, because it's a remarkable situation there. And did you know that Red Cross responds to 3 fires a day, every day in the greater Atlanta area? No, I didn't know. Well, let me tell you a nice story. So then they give you your 67 Red Cross speech about, your 62nd Red Cross speech about what they did. And what happens now, the interviewer is thinking, not thinking that you've been unemployed for 18 months, thinking like you're like a volunteer
superhero
is what you are. I mean, goodness gracious, you already got the interview because they know that you're an accountant, but now they're interested in somebody who really puts himself out there. The 18 months just disappears when you have that great. People talk about the elevator speech.
Mm-hmm.
This is the nonprofit speech. This is a 60-second soundbite about the real you, the passionate you, the person who contributes to the workplace.
Yeah, yeah, great stuff. And are these the kind of things I would imagine in your lectures or in your discussions you go through with people?
Absolutely. We go through each one and see which ones resonate, because there's no silver bullet, but it gets along the lines of, you know, finding things you're passionate about, finding things you have in common with people, and I'll talk about that. What is it that you have in common? So when someone contacts me and they said, do you know anyone at Home Depot who's in logistics and supply chain? I said, what do you expect me to do? So we also talk about what do you have in common with people that makes them want to connect with you? So it could be something as simple as, well, I graduate from Iowa State, you graduate from Iowa State, we're both Buckeyes. Okay, that's a start. But if you're also a graduate of the Fisher College of Business, well, that narrows it down from 500,000 people to 62,000.
Yeah, yeah.
So you look for commonality, things you have in common with people.
Yeah, yeah, great stuff, really great stuff. We could probably go on for another hour with you, but that's we're going to have you back for sure.
Sure.
All right. So I've got one more question for you, Mike, and that is, a pearl of wisdom that you might give to our listeners from experiences that you've had?
Yeah. Real simple would be, what goes around comes around. Just pay it forward, and over time, good things will happen.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. If somebody wants to get in contact with you, is there a way that they can do that? Or
I'm in LinkedIn.
Okay.
They could find me there.
So it's Mike Esposito.
Michael. It goes by Michael Esposito Michael, okay. on LinkedIn.
All right. It's Esposito.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you, Mike. We appreciate it.
You bet.
All right. So our next guest is Stuart Johnson. And Stuart is with Barnes and Thornburg, and he's a partner there. He's the man, the myth, the legend down there in the Buckhead area and turning Barnes and Thornburg into a powerhouse down here in Atlanta. And I had lunch with Stuart 2 weeks ago, wasn't it?
Somewhere around there, right.
Two, 3 weeks ago. We had a great conversation and asked him to come on the show to kind of go through some of his experiences, and he's been through some certainly challenges as well. Stuart, maybe you could give a little bit of background to our listeners, kind of where you came from and what you're doing now.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for having me here, and I'm sorry I'm actually talking behind Mike because that was very inspiring. Thank you for sharing that.
Thanks, Stuart.
I'm a business lawyer. I've been practicing law here in Atlanta for 25 years, and am now with the firm, as you mentioned, Barnes and Thornburg. We're 550 lawyers and 12 offices. Atlanta is one of our newer offices. We opened the office here a little over 2 years ago, and we're bringing our focus on sort of value-oriented legal services to this market. And approach it a little bit in the way that Mike was describing. The law business at its most basic level as a private practitioner is a relationship business. And if you can develop relationships that are strong and enduring and focused on things that that are similar to what Mike was saying, paying it forward and looking for ways to help people as opposed to just solve problems. It tends to come back and pay for itself in spades.
Well, it seems you've done a pretty good job of that. I think in the last 4 years, which has not been like the boom of the decade, well, of the century, I guess. What have you done, and how have you grown? Because your practice has grown from, I think, 4 to 54 attorneys in the last.
Well, we've here in Atlanta, we've grown from one of us and no phones and and sort of working out of Starbucks to as of tomorrow, 21 lawyers in our office here, 35 people in the office, and our firm in general has taken advantage of an economy in which folks have tended to turn inwards, and sort of focus on things that are more inwardly focused than relationship building focused, and we've gone in the other direction and looked externally and grown. We've added probably 100 people in the last two and a half years, and that's including the numbers that we've added here on the ground in Atlanta.
Right, right, amazing. I remember hearing a story in 2009 when a lot of people were having issues in terms of job transition. The attorneys, for the first time in decades, were like, oh my God, I could possibly lose my job. It wasn't, hey, I'm going to go for a partnership over here or over there or a better gig over here or over there. It was, I might get laid off. And that was not something that it seems like the law profession is used to.
Right. Well, it certainly isn't. I mean, it's been an eye-opening experience, I think, for everybody. And lawyers are not excluded from that. I mean, it's obviously been challenging for all of us over the last couple of years.
Well, tell us a little bit about Barnes and Thornburg, about the company, the who you guys work with, the kind of law that you practice.
Well, we are we call ourselves a working lawyer law firm, right? And we focus on sort of hands-on, direct involvement in helping our clients and our friends to solve legal problems. A difference in emphasis, I guess, not difference in sort of substance is. We tend to be you roll up your sleeves and you solve problems for people, and you're focused on the result as opposed to the process. I say to folks all the time, and my practice is I'm a business lawyer, right? And I tend to help people buy and sell things or enter into arrangements with other folks. you know, sort of address legal needs as they come up. And, you know, my focus always tends to be, and our firm's culture is this way, you know, let's solve the problem and focus on what is the ultimate goal here, as opposed to, you know, all of the intricacies to get to that ultimate goal. And it's amazing how many times you hear from people, you know, clients or friends or whatever, gosh, that's different than what my former lawyer did or this other person I know did. And, you know, it's an interesting dynamic.
So you as a partner, they're actually still running a business. Your clients, you're still working clients.
Not absolutely. I'm the managing partner of our office here in Atlanta. And I like to say I spend 50% of my time practicing law. I spend 50% of my time looking for other colleagues to join us here in Atlanta because we're growing this office. And I spend the other 50% of my time, you know, marketing and doing what Mike was talking about, which is maintaining relationships, because that's very important to me.
So you're not at home very often.
Well, I spend the other 50% of my time with my family.
That's right.
Yeah.
So out of the 200%, you're in good shape.
Right, exactly.
Everyone gets their share, right?
Right.
That's awesome. So I understand you've got a book?
I've written a variety of things on, you know, sort of issues and dynamics to be, considered as you're, you know, thinking about something strategic for your business. My clients tend to be entrepreneurial oriented businesses.
Yep.
You know, it may be a very large entrepreneurial oriented business. It may be a much smaller one. And you know, the dynamic and the conversation. And I've done some publication in areas of sort of things to focus on as you consider what your, you know, sort of what the next step in growing or expanding your business may be.
So if you work a lot of business owners who are, I would imagine, selling and people that are looking to buy and deal with all that, what kind of things do our listeners need to be looking for? As a small business owner that might be looking to sell their business, that are mistakes that you see happen all the time?
One that sort of is a typical one, right? That you see on a regular basis. I call it the make sure you know where the race cars and airplanes are mistake, right? And what I mean by that is that you know, closely held companies, you know, someone who is operating a business that really they own, right?
Yeah,
and
right.
No one else does.
Yeah. They have a little discretion.
Yeah, you tend to have a lot of stuff, right, in the business that, you know, if somebody were to look at it from the outside, they would sort of scratch their head as to why it's there.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, sort of the simple lesson there is before you have other people come in and, you know, that before you put yourself in a position where third parties are going to come in and look at your information sort of objectively, you probably want to separate the personal stuff from the business stuff.
Right.
You'd be amazed at how many times that creates an issue when you go into a conversation with an investor, because they get distracted, right?
And it's all of a sudden this little minutia of nothingness,
right.
But it's blown up into this huge problem.
Right.
Yeah. And what about on the buying side of things? I mean, obviously look out for those kinds of things. I guess that falls on both sides.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the biggest issue on the buy side, and this is very interesting because I had this conversation as I was coming in the door this morning with a client friend who's considering buying. The biggest issue on the buy side is not to fall in love with a business, right? Make sure that your focus is very objective, right? I mean, there are dynamics when people get engaged that they really, and it's just like anything else, right? It's like going and buying a house, right? You know, you want to make sure that you're relatively objective sort of going into it, because if you fall in love with that house, you probably are going to overpay for it.
I'm dealing with that one right now because we're changing offices.
Right.
Trying to figure out, you know, office space and looking at where to go. And, you know, 29th floor in the King Building with these glass partitions all over the place and a view of the, you know, the whole continent. And then you go into like a first floor building with no windows and you got to be thinking about, well, you know, it's more than just the view, right?
Right.
So how has your business been in that area? I mean, obviously with the economy doing what it's doing and kind of struggling along, has there been a lot of acquisitions going on?
It's fascinating. I was involved in a panel discussion that I help facilitate every year for the Georgia Society of CPAs, sort of talking about that very issue, sort of what does the business acquisition world look like, and we seem to be schizophrenic, to be honest. I mean, folks look at you see all the things that are happening in the newspaper, and folks are sort of scared about engaging in activity. But on the other hand, the people who are professional buyers, and what I'm talking about here are private equity groups, their comments for at least at the smaller end, what we call middle market businesses, lower to medium-sized middle market businesses, there seems to be a lot of activity out there. I mean, what's happened is that because we've been in this challenging environment for a while, really good business owners have rationalized their businesses, right? They've focused on their knitting, and they've many of them have done very good jobs in sort of rationalizing what their business is, and folks like that who have now decided that they are would be interested in considering a transaction probably have some pretty good alternatives.
So then they button down the books and things look a little bit tighter in terms of what a purchaser might want to be looking at?
Right.
The venture business in Atlanta always seems to be second tier, it almost seems like, versus West Coast or Chicago or New York or in these areas that might be a little bit more vital, more active. What do you see as being things that need to change to help that, or do you see that picking up at all here in Atlanta?
Well, I think it. I do see it picking up. I see lots of folks who are, who are paying attention to that issue. I do think sort of on the constructive criticism side, there are we could clearly use more early stage investor professionals in our community. On sort of the positive side, we have seen a lot of change there, and we continue to see more and more activity happening. I mean, there are great organizations and great events that are occurring here that give more visibility to earlier stage, opportunities, and I'm very encouraged about how that looks going forward.
How about on the even before that, maybe the angel investing? It sounds like there's a lot of activity, a lot of groups, people are getting together to create these angel investment opportunities. Have you seen activity there change much?
There continues to be sort of a good level of investment opportunity and activity there. Yes.
Back to the company in terms of the breadth that you guys serve. Obviously, your business is focused on business transition for the most part. What are the other areas that you guys really can hit the ball out of the park on?
Well, we're a value oriented full service commercial law firm, and there are really four areas where we shine and have specific expertise and experience both here locally and in our larger firm, and that is the business representation in the fashion that I was describing earlier, and it's broader than just transactional. I call it outside general counsel work. You solve the problems that folks are addressing as closely held or entrepreneurially oriented businesses. We have a very strong labor and employment practice. I mean, that is a core competency of us through our law firm. We address things like Mike was describing earlier for that he deals with from at Home Depot, but from the outside, from the legal counsel perspective. We have a very strong intellectual property practice, both helping people protect IP rights and helping people address disputes that may be related to IP rights. And then we have a very strong sort of traditional litigation practice that is you know, that's all focused on, you know, helping companies to solve problems and address issues from a strategic business perspective.
Have you seen much activity in the hiring? Is it picked up on the attorney side of things?
For us, yes.
Well, obviously,
absolutely.
Grew tenfold or so in the last 4 years. But other groups, organizations, are they pulling back? Are they starting to hire again, or is it still pretty stable?
You know, I think there's a lot of steady state activity. You know, it depends on who you're looking at. For businesses like ours, right, that are, you know, our value proposition that we share with the market, and hopefully our clients agree with this, is that our price points are value focused, right? And we roll up our sleeves and get engaged in activities. And you know, companies that we're particularly most companies are looking for that now, right? They're looking for someone who can deliver service at a value proposition that makes sense for them. And you know, we and there are some others here in town, you know, who are really laser focused on that approach, are doing well in this market.
Great.
Can I just make one quick comment?
Yeah, please.
This is Mike. To build on what Stuart says, you asked the question, I think, about the extent to which there's movement in the marketplace for as far as hiring goes. Stuart addressed that from the perspective of his firm, which is doing extraordinarily well in this economy. What I've been seeing is that this pent-up demand for the right talent to take the company from where they are and into the new economy. I think Stuart talks about companies rationalizing their businesses. The past few years, there was very little movement at the top, some of the senior executive positions, because they said, we got to hunker down. It's the devil I know is better than the devil I don't. But I think now there's a realization that this is the status quo. The best we can hope for now is the status quo for some indeterminate period of time. And so what's happening, I believe, is that they're looking internally, looking at their staffs and saying, is this the team that can take us through this the new economy?
The new norm.
Right.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of that on the executive side. So you've kind of seen the executive levels, the C-suite, the VP suite, those kinds of people getting hired in.
Yeah,
bit more.
I think the challenge and the opportunity in the world that we live in, and this is both for us as a law firm and for any other enterprise out there. I mean, someone said to me as I was looking to join this firm 2.5 years ago, you know, they made a comment that really stuck in my head, and that is, you know, in times like this, right, this is when real enterprises are built, right? You know, when everybody else is, sort of hunkered down a bit, right? If you really sort of focus on what your opportunity is, right, and you get the right players in the bus to help you with that, and you execute hard on, you know, on whatever your business opportunity is, you can create an enterprise that has real lasting value.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do, and I'm seeing clients do that all the time, and it's very exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of fun. It's stressful at times, but it's amazing what grows out of the ashes. So,
right.
So last question, Stuart. Pearl of wisdom that you might share with our listeners.
I love to tell this story, and this is sort of my core practice as I was describing earlier, is, you know, helping people with strategic, you know, sort of transactional activity, buying, selling, financing, whatever it is. When I was a very young lawyer, I worked with an older mentor, and he used to, as we got to a closing of a transaction, he would give our client a Frederick Remington print, and this is a print that has a cowboy sitting on the top of a cliff with his horse next to him, and he's looking over the cliff, and there's an elk that's down on a rock outcropping below him that he has shot, and he's scratching his head because he's looking down at this elk, right?
Yeah,
because he can't reach it. And the caption on that print is, meats not meat, until it's in the pan. And I say to my clients who are engaged in transactional activities all the time, you know, that's how you need to think about your transaction, right? Don't count your eggs before they're hatched. Don't do all those kinds of things.
Don't buy the race car team until the deal is done, right?
Exactly. And make sure your spouse or your significant other or whoever it is sort of has that same attitude. So meat's not meat until it's in the pan.
I like it. We have to put that on the website. Well, thank you, Stuart. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
If somebody wants to get in contact with you or the firm, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Well, as Mike was describing earlier, I'm also on LinkedIn, and if you do a search for me, you'll find it, and that's an easy way to do so.
Okay. Well, we appreciate it. So our next guest is Lee Pattier, and Lee is our doctor in the office. No, not of the medical side, not the MD type, but he's the brain type. And the thing about Lee that I noticed is that Lee has, you know, you have those signs on the license plates that say like split family, and it has like a Florida and a Georgia sign there. Lee is a split guy. He's got degrees from too many schools. Who do you root for?
Who do I root for? I think that's a great question, John. You know, probably, you know, one would be the University of Pittsburgh. It's hard to say here. The University of Florida. And the fact that I was in the South Florida
Bulls. How
about them Bulls? I mean, who would have thought several years ago that the University of South Florida that started football in 1997 would be ranked number 2 in the country.
Right.
So talking about the public relations value of football and athletics is just amazing.
Yeah, crazy. I mean,
so those are three.
We were talking about Eckerd College a little earlier. That was my alma mater. We had a flag football team. It's very exciting. You know, we went to the all region club championship of the southwestern hemisphere of two schools, and we had wakeboarding. Water skiing at that time, and we had sailing, and windsurfing, and those were our big sports. So, you know, South Florida, you know, took that to another level and just went right to football, which is pretty impressive.
Sure,
but you don't know you have no idea who to cheer for ever.
Well, you know, just the fact that I cheer for those three teams, but when they play each other, it really becomes problematic.
Yeah,
for sure.
My sister had the same problem. Georgia and Florida, so she really has. That's even worse, I think.
Sure.
So at any rate, tell us a little bit about your background, because it's way too broad for me to get into.
Okay. Well, John, I've spent the last 35 years working in the field of higher education. I started out in student affairs and was in the housing world and worked at the University of Tennessee, and then at Florida Atlantic University. And then, and because of some family circumstances, had to come back and just help raise a brother in Clearwater. And I worked at the University of South Florida for 14 years in the alumni and the development space. Then one day, the University of Pittsburgh called, and they wanted to come have me chat with them. And I said, Pittsburgh? I said, I've seen those Steeler games. I said, I'm from Tampa, Florida. No way am I going to Pittsburgh.
Am I going up there? Are you kidding me?
Are you kidding me? It snows up there.
Hard.
It's hard. You know, it's one of those classic cases that you never say never. And you go and you really, you know, just fall in love with the place. And we've talked a lot about the importance of relationships. Great people, wonderful institution, a fairly underdeveloped type of alumni program. And I was, at Pitt for 17 years. And then really it was fun to see that institution grow and develop. And speaking of sports, Pitt has won 9 national football championships. So some people don't know that, but it's
certainly
impressive.
What decade was that?
Well, okay, the last was 1976 with Tony Dorsett.
Tony. I never liked Tony. I'm a Redskins fan.
Oh, are you? Okay. We're talking serious.
He messed us up bad. He really
was. With the Cowboys, right?
Oh, God, he was not good.
So, and that was good. And then one day the University of Florida called, and they wanted me to come down and talk to them about the Alumni Association there and 350,000 Gators. Great affinity. And at both, at Pitt and at Florida, I helped to plan and direct a multi-billion-dollar capital campaign. So I learned a lot about fundraising and alumni relations.
Yep.
And then I've been doing, in fact, part-time consulting since 1983. And then after Tim Tebow and a national championship, and we have family here in Atlanta, we said it's time to take the firm full-time. So in December of last year, it's now a full-time firm, and we have clients from all over the country. And we're really now looking to do more and more work here in Atlanta and throughout the state.
So tell us a little bit about the consulting. Who are your clients? What are you providing to them? What's the end line product, if you will?
Sure. Right now, people are looking for more and more revenue. Just when you look at the national news and you see just all these budget cuts. For example, here in the state of Georgia, the state system just got a 12% budget cut. So now, and they're looking for new sources of revenue. Places like the University of Georgia are a client. And so I'm helping them with fundraising, with strategic planning, constituent engagement. You know, we know from our literature, my PhD background, that engagement leads to investment. So when you have a place like the University of Florida, how do you engage a fair percentage of 350,000 alumni? Sometimes it could be student recruitment, sometimes it could be legislative, sometimes it could be careers, sometimes it's fundraising. So what I bring is kind of a background of having done this for 33 years and also studying best practice. So I've been part of a national consortium of the 100 executive directors from large alumni associations. Stewart's from Virginia, and then Michael is from Ohio State.
Yep.
So I know their executive directors real well.
Yeah,
and what's exciting about this field is there's no competition. You know, so Tom at Virginia will share thoughts, and then, you know, in terms of my counterpart at Ohio State will.
Yeah.
And happens to be a two-time Heisman Trophy winner.
Yeah.
Okay, named Archie Griffin. So he's the alumni director there.
Yeah.
At Ohio State.
Yep. And they are sharing ideas with you, and then you use those ideas, or each other? Are they helping each other come more in a symbiotic relationship?
Yeah, they really help in terms of each other, and because we have common concerns about how do you raise all this money, how do you engage a very diverse group, how do you engage these young alumni who were so involved in social media and these kinds of things? So, and we talk a lot about strategy, and now in this firm, I have developed a national advisory board of 45 industry leaders, and they are a tremendous help. So I'm working on certain projects. I can call up USC, UCLA, Notre Dame, Penn State, and they're all part of this group. And so it's almost like having a bullpen. So just when you need, in terms of an inning or perhaps two innings or perhaps a new perspective, you just call them up and you chat about some particular client and their needs.
And so I understand you work also with not just educational facilities, but also nonprofits. So you've been doing some work with nonprofits as well. How does that, your experience in dealing with the educational fundraising is different than the charity? I mean, I've done a lot of charity work with the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation and, you know, Mike with Red Cross, I believe it was.
Yep.
So we've all got charities that we've done. How does that correlate? I mean, is there a direct correlation with how you fundraise with educational foundations versus nonprofits, or is it different?
Great question. It's really a similar process. It's, for example, in a case like Red Cross, and you're trying to, in a sense, identify the interest of the donor and how that matches the needs of the institution, or in a case like this, Red Cross. So you're always trying to listen and understand what is important to the donor. For example, Michael works with Home Depot. They have a certain list of high priorities. Veterans is one of their priorities.
Yeah.
So as I work with my donors and they have kind of veteran needs, we'll talk about that. One of my clients is a fascinating story. Happens to be a Delta pilot who has a great and desire to help folks with disabilities. So he wants to reconfigure airplanes to be able to move people in wheelchairs. So right now, if you're in a, confined to a wheelchair, it is very hard to travel on kind of conventional air. So he's got this heart, and I'm helping him establish a 501c3, but that is grassroots. So he's got to form a, talk to his attorney and establish that 501c3, and then just build a board, raise money, in a sense, tell the case. So a lot of similarities that you need a board, you need people who are passionate about what you're doing, and you need to have a plan, and you need to be able to bring in the dollars, and you have to be able to step back and and tell the story in a host of ways. So a lot of parallels, a lot of parallels. And plus, I do teach for the Georgia Center for Nonprofits, and I'm also one of their consultants. So I teach things about board and development, about nonprofits, but it's very similar.
All right, so now I got.
Could I ask Lee a quick question?
Yeah, I was going to totally pick his brain, but you go.
Well, no, two things. When you talked about identifying that interest of the donor, connecting that with the nonprofit, at the Red Cross, we refer to that as listening for the ask.
Listening for the ask, exactly.
Making that connection. But I have one quick question. You talked about that engagement brings investment.
Right.
Do you have any advice on how the university can most effectively engage its alumni so that you do get that investment back?
Right now what we're seeing is a great trend in market research, okay? Now, who would think that, you know, alumni associations have one or two staff members who are doing nothing but market research? So we have to understand, what do you need? What do you expect from us? So then you do your research, and in today's world, number one is really career networking in terms of alumni. But in terms of nonprofits, and you have to then step back and see, you know, how does it work? And we use the five I's. You have to identify, inform, then you interest, involve, and invest. So we have to be able to inform you. And so in today's world, you know, that's not simple, because you got all these emails, you got all these Twitters, you know, these tweets, and then you get phone calls and you get direct mail. So we have to find some way to inform you. Then we have to find out, what are you interested in? What does John really want? He wants the water ski club, or, you know, in whatever it might be. Then, and we have to find some ways to involve John, or you, Michael, or Stuart. So we'll say, okay, would you come in and talk to our students about how did you use these skills to help be successful in business? And then they see the need, and they say, oh, my goodness, well, they need a new sailboat, or they need a new ski boat, or whatever. And then
they're writing a check.
Would you like to name this, John? We have the John Baker.
Can you envision it?
Can you envision it?
That's right, the sign of the biz. Yeah.
Then when you're graphic design people, and you have it kind of, you know, through desktop publishing,
brilliant.
Have it right there, have John Baker. So it's available for you for only $15,000.
You too.
But that's the process.
Have your name on a sailboat.
You too. Yeah, but, you know, I mean, and we stop and joke a little bit, but I think it's really about changing lives and saving lives.
Right.
That's what it's all about. And so many times we lose sight of the mailing or the special event, but we're really talking about those three fires per day here in Atlanta, people who don't have homes, people who don't have food, and how can you make a difference?
Give me an example of a fundraising idea that was one of those unique ideas that just you knocked the cover off the ball with it. And let's see if you can focus not on the educational side, but on what a lot of us work on with charity events or just charity fundraisers, or any ideas on that?
Sure. One of my colleagues is here in Atlanta, and what they do is they do silent auctions. But what makes them so different? They bring in, you know, the items, and they don't charge the charity a dime. And what they'll do is they'll build in 30% in terms of the opening bid, and goes straight back to the charity. And last year, they helped about 500 charities raise about $1 million. So it's a great way to involve people. And there's all sorts of strategies about how to do that. But it's important to keep in mind that, you know, kind of the big money is raised through individual major gifts. So folks like these golf tournaments and things like that, but they're very staff intensive. So if you're serious about raising kind of the big dollars, that goes back to individual major giving. So nationally, about 80% of all money comes from individuals.
And that's really going back to the five I's that you talked about,
absolutely.
Really.
Absolutely.
You got to make sure they know what's going on. You got to make sure it's important to them as individuals, and you got to be able to get out there and customize it to that person, then that follow-up, and then, you know, eventually the ask, right?
Yeah, because, you know, in fact, it takes between 18 and 24 months from first identification from that phase into the closure phase, because people have to understand who you are and what you do. And it's really a process. And to make sure that what you're talking about is really relevant to them.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about you. It's about them.
Completely. Yeah. You know? And Mike made a great point about about, you know, listening for the ask, I think is what you said. And that's so, that is so the key, is if it's, if you make that connection, you know, you start, you, well, I'll give you a personal example. I just met with a guy named Tom Schneider. He's from Eckerd. He's on the alumni. He's the alumni guy. He's, he made the ask today for me to co-chair something, right? And they're just building the science building. And last year he made an ask for me to do the science building. I'm like, I'm not a science guy. You know, I'm a business, you know, econ guy. I don't care if you build a science building or not. But if you asked me to raise money for the water ski team or for the volleyball team, I'd have probably written a check, although they don't have those anymore. So it would have been kind of hard. But yeah, it's so much that personal identification and the impact that they can make that they really care about. That's the key, right?
Right, right. Exactly right.
Yeah. Exactly. Great stuff. Right. Great stuff. So last question, which is pearl of wisdom. What would you give as your pearl of wisdom?
Let me share one story. Stuart talked about a story. One of my favorite alums from Pitt is a guy named Frank Bolden. Frank Bolden died a few years ago. He's an African-American who was one of the two accredited war correspondents in World War II. And so in 1943, this guy had time to spend with Gandhi, Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt. I mean, talking about the worldview of leaders. And he said to me one day, he said, Lee, your people came over in one boat, and my people came over in a second boat, but today we're in the same boat, so grab an oar and let's get rowing. You know, and that's what life is about. We need to be in the same boat, rowing in the same direction. So whether you're working on a capital campaign or helping to involve people in some activity, let's make sure the fact we're in the row, in the same boat. And there's so much, you know, that can be done when you're all moving in the same direction. And it's a team effort. It's not one person.
Perfect. Perfect. So, Lee, if somebody wants to reach out to you guys and engage your services or maybe even just have a chat, what's the best way to get in contact?
And they can find us there on LinkedIn as well, and or they can go to our website, www.patouilleconsulting.com.
You got to spell that, man.
P-A-T-O-U-I-L-L. E-T.
E-T, yeah.
E-T, and then they can go to the website, and we have a newsletter, and they can subscribe to that. And that's really about advancement, nonprofit trends, and views. So people want to see what's happening in the space, and then and so we you know just write about that as well.
All
John,
right.
And thank you for and for the invitation.
My pleasure. It was a great day, and I appreciate all our guests for coming on. Hopefully we'll have a chance to catch back up with you guys in the future and see how things are going. I also appreciate the time of our listeners for tuning in. Hopefully you enjoy the show today. Until next week, be safe.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA. SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation.